Hello everyone and everybody. Hello, Professor Charles Dario Ferro. Thank you very much that you accepted our invitation in the name of Group of Philosophy of Religion, the Faculty of Philosophy of Religion, Institute of Humanities and Cultural Studies. I must thank you for accepting this invitation. Your name in Iran is not unknown. As I told you, some of your works is translated in Farsi, but my colleagues has read you before translation of these books in English. For those who are not so acquainted with you, I must say that Professor Charles Dario Ferro is what was about 36 years professor at St. Olaf College. He served as chair of the philosophy department from 2013 to 2019, teaching previously at the University of Massachusetts, the University of Notre Dame, and Middle Essex Community College. He has written written many important books in philosophy of religion, and he was editor of very important encyclopedias in this area. One of his books is, for example, Philosophy of Religion, A Beginner's Guide. Another book is A Brief History of the Soul. Another book is Aesthetic, A Beginner's Guide. And the long list of his articles, his participation in international conferences, his scientific activities is longer that I can mention here. Professor Dario Ferro, thank you very much again. Please, stage are yours.
Thank you very much. And Salam Aleikum. It has been 8 years since I've been to Iran, and it's a pleasure to be here. I am Zooming with you from apartment, which is essentially a huge library. And while it has been 8 years since I have been to Iran, I do hope to return. It is a pleasure also to be in a conference with Mohammed Saeedi Meir, whom I have worked with on the Encyclopedia of Philosophy of Religion. He is a dear friend, and as are so many Iranians, philosophers, and others whom I deeply admire. What I would like to do this morning with you is to discuss the revival of interest in the meaning of life, to take up three major areas of the meaning of life, and to discuss with you why philosophy of religion is such of enduring importance in considering the meaning of life. First, a word on the meaning of life. When people ask about the meaning of life, usually one is asking what exists, what is going on, and what is its significance. Now, from the beginning of philosophy, East and West and the Middle East and the Near East, the meaning of life is central. It's central to all the great thought that we have in history. So in Iran, pre-Islamic, Zoroastrian, the largest religion in the world at one point, was extraordinary in terms of its power of giving persons a vision of life and an understanding of its significance. In Islamic Iran and throughout the Arabian Peninsula and then Africa and the Far East, with Muslim philosophers engaging in visions of reality and value, you, of course, have Muslim philosophers wrestling with Quranic teachings, the Hadith, tempering the notion of meaning and interpretation, the Shia versus the Sunni, eventually the Sufis, and so on. But you have a rich tradition of concern for meaning and how to live. Some of it inherited from the Greeks and Romans, and some, like Al-Kindi, persons of genius, Al-Farabi, Al-Ghazali, people of their own expertise and interests. In the West, pre-Christian West, obviously Plato, Aristotle, the Epicureans, the skeptics, all of these schools of thought were concerned with the meaning of life. How should we live? And what is there? And this is true of the origin of first recorded thinking in China with Confucianism, and eventually, obviously, with the advent of Taoism. And from India comes Buddhism into China, but Buddhism, the Vedas, Hinduism, all of recorded philosophy has been concerned with, in a sense, the meaning of life. However, in the mid-20th century, the topic of the meaning of life in the West became obscured. And largely this was because it was assumed that a scientific understanding of life was sufficient to tell us who we are, what the cosmos is, and perhaps even to contribute to some account of how we should live. So in the middle of the 20th century, when the famous Western philosopher Bertrand Russell was asked, this is a famous anecdote, he was in a taxi cab and he was asked, what's it all about? What's the meaning of life? And he is supposed to have been completely apoplectic, completely baffled. What do you mean, what's the meaning of life? And he could have answered the question of what the meaning of life is, but he probably interpreted the question, what is the meaning of life, in terms of, well, is there a God who has purposed that we should live a certain way? Is there a plan? And Russell, through much of his life, all his life, did not believe there was such a meaning. But he did actually believe there was the following meaning of life, namely, there is no purpose of life. Life is the result of chance and necessity, of mindless forces. There are no objective values. Values, for Russell, are a function of our desires and our preferences. He once said that to say you like compassion is like saying you like strawberries. So he did have an account of what life is about. Life is about being short and having no origin and purpose, and it will end in annihilation. For Russell, it will end in the death of the self and the death of the planet and the galaxy. So he thought that life did have some kind of meaning, but that meaning was very dark. Now, the meaning of life persisted in the 20th century among existentialists, among Heidegger, who actually did have an influence in Iran at one point in the 1940s. It had a role in Marxism, which was a competitor in the Islamic Revolution. There's been Marxist elements in Iran from time to time. And these had visions of the meaning of life. According to Marxism, each of us is an ensemble of social relations. material economic ones. But they wouldn't use the term the meaning of life to spell that out. Still, the meaning of life as a topic has revived. There are now in the West major publications by our most prestigious publications, Oxford, Cambridge, the oldest universities in Britain. Actually, there's Islamic University in what's now Morocco that predates Oxford and Cambridge, but our in the West, our oldest university presses have conferences now on the meaning of life, and Harvard University in the United States, one of the leading universities in my country, has a Department of Human Flourishing, which had a recent conference on the meaning of life. Now, I'd like to consider why the meaning of life has revived as a topic and what relevance it has for philosophy of religion today. And there are three areas to consider. First is the meaning of life has come back because, one, there's been a reawakening of philosophy of religion in the West, and an understanding of the great diversity of frameworks we have in order to understand life. And ordinary people, educated people, are wanting to read books now of how to guide their lives, whether it's in light of a broader religious or secular worldview, or there is now a movement which stresses the idea that there's meaning in life. Even if life doesn't have a purpose, you can find meaning in life itself. Now, I think I'm going to just pause and dig into that and then go on to the two other reasons for why the meaning of life literature has revived. But on this first point, I would say that the diversity of different frameworks for framing life's decision making is very compelling. That is, we are no longer in a culture, we and who have access to internet, we have now access to not just Islam, but Judaism, Christianity, different forms of Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, Japanese, indigenous thought, traditional thought in Africa. Africa is roughly 40% Islamic, and 40% Christian, and the rest is traditional African thought, various admixtures. In all of these cultures, and in Latin America, so in all the continents of the world, we now have access. There are forms of censorship and so on, but most people who have access to the internet have access to these alternative ways of viewing your life. Now, one major thinker, Thaddeus Metz, M-E-T-Z, who wrote the Meaning of Life entry in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, free and online, he proposes that debate about the existence of God, whether of Allah or Yahweh or the God of Christianity, he thinks that's irrelevant for life's big questions. And that's interesting because many thinkers in the past have claimed that whether or not there's a God or a creator, a redeemer, a judge, Kant even. A lot of modern thinkers, from John Locke, Aquinas, many thinkers in the West, Plato, Aristotle, of course, Al-Ghazali, Al-Farabi, Avicenna, many of them, less so in the East, Far East, like Confucius, but many have thought the existence of God is crucial. But Thaddeus Metz thinks not. He thinks that believing in God gives you maybe two options. One, it can give you perhaps an afterlife. But he thinks you could get an afterlife other routes. We'll discuss that in a minute. He thinks that acknowledging God can give you a religious dimension to life, to give you meaning. He calls it pleasing the boss. It's a very odd phrase. I want to examine that. And then he also, very interestingly, believes that if you acknowledge the existence of God, you are creating not just a grounds for meaning, but a huge ground for meaninglessness. I'd like to focus in on this last argument first. His thesis is that if you believe that there is a God, and that gives your life meaning, in a positive way, this gives you the pleasing the boss, and may give you immortality, but what if you bet there is no God? What if you think that there is no creator? For those people, life becomes utterly meaningless. He used the term anti-meaning. One way to put his point is that if you believe there is a provident God, it is likely you also believe there is a hell. Hell will be anti-meaning. And so the existence of God or the belief in God can encumber or burden us with anti-meaning. Now, I'd like to spend a little time analyzing that thesis. One observation is that Thaddeus Metz's contention, and you can find him again on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Meaning of Life, and he's published with Cambridge, The God and the Meaning of Life. You'll find that his notion that if you acknowledge God, you open the door for many people having no meaning whatsoever, you'll find the same result if you accept that there are truths about morality. Let's say you believe that justice and compassion are good. Let's say that's true. Well, those that do not accept the virtues of justice and compassion seem to be, on his lights, perhaps meaningless. Now, I want to challenge that in just a minute. But if the choices are going with God and the goodness is meaningful, but going with evil and hell is meaningless, well, if you believe in justice and compassion, then you believe that cruelty and injustice will be the opposite, will be meaningless. So I find this argument very curious because it's meant to be anti-theistic, that is monotheistic, anti-belief in God, but it turns out that it would work against believing in moral realism, that is believing there are real truths about justice and compassion. However, let me go further. Is it the case that in Islam or Christianity or theistic Hinduism or Judaism, is it the case that rejecting God or the good is meaningless? Well, on many views of many philosophers, rejecting the good is profoundly meaningful. It's not without significance. In fact, it may be the most significant fact about one's life. If you choose a life of tyranny, this can be profound. Now, especially, I think, for Muslims, perhaps the majority of those listening to me, if there are any out there, with a belief in divine judgment, then this is profoundly meaningful. The afterlife is understood in terms of retribution. It also, for Christians, many of whom believe that the afterlife is a matter of freedom. The belief is that hell is self-created. You can find this in Milton and in some New Testament passages, whereas it appears as though hell itself can be here and now. You can make hell for other people and for yourself now. And this can continue in an individual dynamic afterlife. Now, some Christians, including myself, I am a practicing Christian, come very close to universalism. That's that ultimately God's love will bring about the of all. Now, this may be familiar with some philosophers with the work of John Hick, who is a pluralist, and he believes that all faiths, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Taoists, Confucius, even secular naturalists, insofar as they pursue the good, under various will ultimately come into fruition with what he calls the real, some of us might call God or ultimate reality. Christian universalists still believe that Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. But those of us who believe that ultimately, through Christ, all persons will come into communion with God. Those of us who are universalists believe there is hell. That is, there can be partition from God. But we believe in the indestructible, ever-searching mercy of God that will not abandon the creation. And so the persons will, a devout Muslim, will who can find mercy and justice in God, in a different world or this world, will find heaven, will find paradise with him. But this notion that belief in God renders oceans of people living meaningless lives seems to me false or a caricature. If anything, believe that your beliefs and the way you live have ultimate significance, whether you commit adultery or cruelty or tyranny or you oppress other people. If this has cosmic implication, this is definitely meaningful. It's substantial. Further, I would say, on Metz's point that you can have immortality in other ways than through the life of God, one of his suggestions is that you can have it through having your life uploaded in a computer. And this seems highly dubious to me, because we human beings are substantial, concrete individuals enduring over time, whereas programs in computers get multiply downloaded in many ways. There's only one me, Charles Taliaferro. There are others that can be clones or that look like me, but there's only one me. I'm not, in technical language, communicable. That is, my individuality, even if somebody looks like me and acts like me, it isn't me. And so that we could become uploaded in computers and downloaded seems not just science fiction, but preposterous. And the idea that communion with God is like pleasing the boss also seems to me very odd. A way to construe the way Muslims and Christians and Hindus view the afterlife of communion with Brahman or Yahweh or with Allah. One has only to read the mystics to hear the great love and joy that Jews and Muslims and Christians speak about communion with God. It's not pleasing a boss, that seems very anthropomorphic, doesn't it? Like a shopkeeper. Whereas if there is a God, as revealed in the Quran, Hebrew Bible, Christian scripture, and tradition, there is a God of indestructible loving compassion with whom one can find a blissful, transformative life of mercy and redemption. So this is not just pleasing the boss. Now, there are two more areas of the meaning of life I'd like to touch on. One area of why the meaning of life has become so big in the West is because of questions of meaning. And for those of you who have a background in philosophy of language, it's very clear to you that what we mean and what we say is a very big topic. There are three schools of thought. One is very subjective. What you mean is what you intend. It's a matter of subject. Another is that meaning is objective. There's a matter of fact that is meant when you speak or when you do things. And the third is a hybrid. Now, this is interesting in the meaning of life literature because some believe that the meaning of life is entirely subjective. If you believe that you are happy or fulfilled, you're happy and fulfilled. Whether it's just stamp collecting or building schools or studying horses, whatever it is, find that satisfying, that's it. Now, in my view, the subjective dimension is important. We should not neglect how people feel and what they intend when it comes to meaning of what we say. But it is not entirely subjective. I might say something that is genuinely sexist or racist or Islamophobic or whatever, and not intend it to be Islamophobic or racist or sexist. And yet, what I'm saying is just like being funny. If you think you're funny, are you funny? If I thought that, I'm funny a lot, but I don't think I am. I try to have a sense of humor, but I'm not that consistent. So I say subjectivity has its place, but what it is actually and what actually is not merely a matter of subjectivity. And this may be common sense. After all, in law around the world, tribunals, international and national, in virtually every country, especially in criminal law, we distinguish between behavior and what the mental state of the person is. In Latin, we call it the mens rea, which means the guilty mind. So I might be moving a piano and I drop it on you. And the question is, was it an accident or not? Now, we can study the rope I'm using and the balance, but it has come down to, did I intend to let this piano go? And so subjectivity is both a legal, and it's true in our language, and I think it's true in terms of how we assess someone's life as being meaningful or not. Now, a third area of the meaning, which is huge in the literature and the conferences, and I'm going to bring it to you, and where I think philosophy of religion has an important role to play, has to do with the role of ethics in determining life's meaning. I've suggested this already, but some have argued from a subjectivist point of view that if you choose to love cruelty, coercion, tyranny, and so on, and you follow through with this, well, your life is meaningful. And I have conceded something like that. That is, I think it's very meaningful when someone is trying to kill you and they're murderous. That's meaningful. But as has been pointed out by when we meaningful, we are often taking up the question about whether we recommend this or we admire this. And on this point, the obvious example people use in the literature is Hitler. And some have argued that Hitler had a very meaningful life. Now, I'm prepared to say the meaning of what he did is very, very important. Killing genocidally 6 million to 8 million people mechanically in beginning or being the source of World War II, millions and millions of dead. That's a meaningful statistic. But for those of us who are Christians or Muslims, theistic Hindus and others, clearly the result of these factors is heinous, is disgusting, is repulsive. And even at a certain point, going back to Thaddeus Mills a little bit, I'll even go so far as to suggest there is a kind of meaninglessness involved, but a kind of, oh, I guess I will say, not absurdity, but there is a kind of mirage involved in these acts of tyranny. Hitler was working with a mirage, an illusion of blood purity. It doesn't exist. And in the name of this illusion, this falsehood, he was prepared to murder, to kill many, many people. And so there is this, I would say, about meaning, and especially for those who believe in an afterlife, the meaning of what one does is not settled by your subjectivity, your preferences, what you want at the time. It's settled only in terms of what actually is the case. In the case of Hitler, he killed persons who are of inestimable value for no good reason whatsoever. Now, to use a lighter example, imagine you and I are pursuing our self-interest with everything we have. What I want is to acquire wealth as possible. That's it. Well, imagine one of the most dominant forms of Buddhism is actually true, and that there is no enduring self, concrete individual over time. In that case, I'm very satisfied when I die as a billionaire, Elon Musk. But in case he's listening, but in any case, if I have the money that he had, I think I'm very satisfied. However, if Buddhism is true, I've lived an illusion. Same thing with atheism. I myself am a practicing theist. Prayers are not to a living God, but to an image, a projection. If atheism is true, my prayers may still be earnest. They make a difference. When I pray for compassion for you, then that may change me. When I was last in Iran and speaking with a Muslim, I asked whether we might pray together. And this was the son of Tahari. And we did. We prayed for each other's well-being. That is a great God. But God or Allah exists. But if they're in Trinity or to divide Muslims in a strict monotheism, of brotherly love is magnified in importance. In my view, the meaning in life, such as my embracing the son of Mutahari, that meaning in life, whether or not there is a divine. But if there is a divine, this is even more extraordinary. Now, just to make sure, I give, if anybody's listening, reasons to challenge me on any number of fronts. I'm going to, well, I'll sum up what I hope I've done so far, but then I'm going to four questions that were brought to me by the leaders of this conference. And let me find them. What I hope to have done then is to have argued, just 1 second. I have written all this down. I've argued that I brought to your attention that the meaning of life was the classical issue, East, West, Middle East, Africa, global. It's submerged under the guise of science. We don't need to learn with meaning when we have science. However, we press diversity of views that confront us now. Go beyond science. You may accept physics, chemistry, and biology, but then you might also consider Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, theistic Hinduism. You make secular naturalism, these other big, big, big worldviews. So you can't, meaning in life, great, but then you are naturally led to these big issues. I've tried to give reasons to believe theism, belief in God, does not condemn us all to, most of us, to meaninglessness. It upgrades us to meaning. I've sought to defend moral realism, and I've sought to make this last point about whether there's a choice between concerning the ethics of a life and the meaningfulness of a life. By my lights, or what I propose, can't separate those. Ethics is part and parcel of meaning. Now, four questions and four replies. So this is kind of a piece. Can philosophy of religion be Islamic, Christian, Jewish, or religion in general? And in what sense? I'm going to propose that, yes, it can be. There is no reason why not. And in fact, this actually is the case. There are Islamic philosophers of religion. And what makes them Islamic is not always, you know, every argument. They may embrace the Kalam cosmological argument, or they may defend a kind of what we call fideism, or they may endorse a teleological element, and so on. But they may take as given the authority of the Quran, perhaps the Hadith, as a method of heuristic interpretation. And that is absolutely fair game. You are a philosopher when you assume a Quranic perspective, and then you ask, is omnipotence compatible with omniscience? Can an all-powerful know all future free acts of God and also of creatures? I'm not going to try to answer that right now, but that, what is the relation? This is from the first surah, between justice and mercy. For a Christian philosopher, you, if there are any Christians that are listening to me, you may take the creeds, the Nicene Creed, the Chalcedon Creed. You may believe in the incarnation of Jesus of Nazareth as the second person of the Trinity, God and human. Well, how is that going to work philosophically? There are currently at least five major schools I am in one of them, that as a philosopher, try to make sense of these beliefs. And so that is doing philosophy in a particular text. And so that can be absolutely legitimate. Second, what is the central problem of religion is the importance of different problems and subjects of philosophy of religion the same. I propose that historically they are often not the same. So, for example, in Northern Europe, one topic for philosophy is the criticism of religion. And this is so important because Sweden and Norway and Denmark have a very large immigrant population. These immigrants are largely, and the worry is that in criticism of Islam, criticism of them as, and so that is an example of when one would not focus as a central problem the criticism of Islam. One might focus in on other matters. One might focus on pluralism or toleration or collaboration or the relationship of science and religion, or one might focus in on divine attributes. But that's a case where right now, 2023, they are, the philosophers are off the table temporarily, the criticism of Islam. They feel like that right now, until there is a more secure social setting, that's not going to be a central problem for philosophers of religion. Another thing to mention in my own country is, perhaps you know, that the topic of racism has very much emerged with the police killing black male unarmed persons. And so there are sayings like Black Lives Matter. Now, clearly for Christians and for most of us, lives matter. Whether you're yellow or red or color matter, but if you're white, you matter. However, under the circumstances where it's black people that are being murdered, then that is the central issue until that can be dealt with fairly. So from time to time, we have to focus in on central matters. So just two more, very, very quick. Third is, what is the meaning or criterion of truth in philosophy of religion? I'm going to just over this last two. And I'll just say, it's obvious that I'm a realist. I believe that if it's true, compassion, justice are virtues, then it's true, whether regardless of your view. Now, truths are important. However, I'll give you an argument of why perspective is not enough, but real objective truths should be our target, but I'll save that. And then finally, one of the questions that jumped out at me is, what is the influence of philosophical commitments of philosophers of religion in the philosophy of religion? This is very appropriate for me because I was the co-editor of a four-volume Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and sub-editors and other editors, some were Muslims, some were Jews, practicing Jews, some were Taoists, Confucius, atheists, some were, very, very sect anti, and so on. As a scholar, I had to bracket my own Christian belief and practice In editing, in my inviting, Graham Opp is a very, very famous. He started off as an agnostic, but now he defends atheism often. And Paul Draper, I've edited with. He varies between agnostic and atheist. I have to embrace them as colleagues, encourage them, and I have to edit their work as compellingly as I can. So the two answers to this is that, yeah, the convictions of philosophers do make a difference in your life. Absolutely. I pray for my colleagues. I'd do that if I wasn't a believer. But in my practice, as a professor and as a writer, I have to step back from those convictions to promote the flourishing of the field. Thank you for your patience. I realize I went on quite a while. I presented a main talk on the meaning of life and philosophy of religion, and then a shot at four of the questions that were asked of contributors. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I think the both parts of your lecture was very inspirative. The part about meaning of life and the answer to all questions. If you allow me, I will begin with a question, and the other participants will write the questions or will say the questions. A philosopher who tries to understand the meaning of the words, it is important to have a understanding of the meaning of word meaning when we speak about the meaning of life. You spoke about it, but would you please tell again two, three sentences about the exact meaning of meaning, as a matter of philosophy of language. What do you mean exactly when you speak about meaning of meaning?
That is a fair and excellent question. That in philosophy of religion, meaning is often the meaning of words is treated two ways. One is in terms of the presumed or original, and so the famous event, Augustine of Hippo, so Augustine, 4th century. He heard a boy singing, "Tele leget." Now, that what the boy said was part of a probably nursery rhyme. Just whatever you happen to be reading, take it up and read. But Augustine interpreted the meaning as that he should take up the Bible. And he read a passage from Paul about grace and salvation. So the second meaning it had for Augustine was from God. He believed it was from God that he should take up and read Scripture and ultimately find God through Scripture. That's where you have two. One of the original speaker, and then how it's said can have a double meaning. One other very controversial example, very, but when in the Old Testament, when Joseph, sorry, is sold into slavery. There's a the writers are attributed with saying, the dreamer, let us kill him and see what happens to his dream. Now, thousands later, 4,000 years later, Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights advocate, was assassinated in America in a museum dedicated to Martin Luther King Jr. That verse actually appears on the museum. Here comes the dreamer, and Martin Luther King Jr. was famous for a sermon, I dream, a black boy and a black girl will someday be together, and he will be killed, and then we will find out what happens to his dream. Now, obviously, authors of Genesis had no idea about Martin Luther King Jr. None. Zippo. They did not mean anything like that. However, in cultural and religious contexts, that verse was then transformed into meaning something about the glory and the goodness of a person who advocates justice and then is assassinated. So that's an example of original meaning is one thing, but it can come to have a different meaning.
Okay, thank you very much. So, if you allow me, I will explain what I understand from your explanation. Is it correct that you mean something happens, something takes place, and we as human being understand something is happening, and this understanding is the meaning? Is it correct?
Yes. But, or let's change the word slightly to significance. The significance of what took place can change or differ. For example, when the crusade from Venice invaded Constantinople, they thought that was it. They're going for Constantinople, but they didn't realize that the fuller meaning was that Constantinople would then fall to the Ottomans, and northern Egypt would also fall before Arab forces. So the meaning of what you do can be what happens at the time, but then over time, its meaning can change.
Okay, thank you very much. I would ask another question about the same topic. So the others will ask also their questions. There is another understanding of meaning in Islamic mysticism. In Islamic mysticism, there are sentences or there are traditions, quotations from mystics who say that the God is the meaning. And in this sense, everything is form of a manifestation of this over-compassing empire, or this one unit meaning. Can you see that the meaning of life can be also understood in this mystical way, that the God is meaning of everything and meaning of the of my life and the other lives.
You're very good. I'm very sympathetic to that position on two fronts. One, in both Islam and Christianity, God is understood to be all-knowing. So, in a sense, we, finite human beings, only know each other and even our own minds partially. You may believe that you are compassionate, justice, fair, but God knows that your students think that you are a little shaky sometimes, certainly, for example. So the meaning of did grade this paper fairly would be something that an omniscient would know, whereas my colleagues, even the student, doesn't know. But then secondly, I believe that what comes along with thinking that God is providential and compassionate is that our faults, our misdeeds, are subject to divine, sometimes redemption, damnation, that many things we do that may seem impossible may be, from a mystical point of view, revised from the point of God. But this is an area we can't run. However, it is cause for, in my view, reverence and caution as human judges of each other and of ourselves, that one greater being than us, for whom the meaning of the world is the last order of reference.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. My colleagues, Professor Akrami, would ask a question. Professor Akrami, would you say your question or write it? We have also, okay, then please turn your microphone on.
Thank you very much, Professor Talib Forel, for your very good presentation. I really appreciate your contribution, especially considering this time of the year when you're supposed to be with your family, relaxing and traveling perhaps, and especially also at this time of night. It's quite very late, even maybe after midnight. I really appreciate that.
It is.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. But I may have a couple of comments and a couple of questions, but at the same time, I don't want to deprive my colleagues and students and everyone else at the panel to ask their questions as well. So I'll try to be as brief as possible. The question of meaning of life is very important, and I'm glad that you kind of talked about it from a historical point of view, the going up and down of the importance of this question in philosophy of religion. That was interesting. But one comment that I have, and it doesn't mean that you would not necessarily disagree with me, I suppose you would agree with me, but I would like to emphasize at this point that in many of our traditions, I'm especially concerned with our religious upbringing, religious pedagogy, and those kind of things, rather than our religious scriptures, the Quran or Hadith or the Bible necessarily. It is kind of maybe a critique of our religious upbringing. At least I'm much more familiar with Islamic tradition and Islamic context. Although on the periphery, we have had a kind of emphasis on by our mystics on the fact that, for example, Rabia Adawiyah, we heard from George Patterson yesterday, our British colleague in this conference, who talked about Rabia Adawiyah, the Muslim woman mystic, who said that God is worthy of worship regardless of the reward and punishment and those kind of things that a human may receive from him because of their actions. But that has been on the periphery of our religious upbringing, generally, very generally speaking. The emphasis in our religious upbringing has been exactly this reward and punishment, which to many thinkers who have not been, for different reasons, for understandable different reasons, sympathetic to religious traditions, it has given them this kind of reason that one may find meaning in life. We were talking about Thaddeus Metz, rather than meaning of life, which is mostly thing that we would find in our traditional understanding of Islam or Christianity or other religions. So this understanding of God, which goes always and always perhaps along with this idea of an experience of punishment and reward, has been quite off-putting to many of our children, especially. And this may also have contributed to a kind of opposition and protests that are now going on in Iran among the youth in Iran. I would like to emphasize that. So maybe the same feeling and experience has been going on in other traditions, in Western traditions as well, that has led these scholars to not talk about the meaning of life, which is mostly based on faith, theistic view of life, and they have rather liked to emphasize meaning in life and a kind of godless, meaningful life. So we need to, I think, pay attention to that, and we need to modify our religious upbringing and religious pedagogy and everything around this kind of new understanding of what has been going on. And a lot can be further said about this. I do not want to expand anymore. But this is one general comment about the meaning of life that I would like to share with you. But I have also a question about the answer that you gave on the first question. Or not we can have Islamic philosophy of religion, Buddhist philosophy of religion, and so on. I can see that many writers have written, not many obviously compared to the basic philosophy of religion that has been Christian, but there have been books. I studied at McGill University. I remember my professor, Arvind Sharma, wrote a book on philosophy of religion from a Hindu, particularly Advaita Vedanta tradition. And there, I haven't come across any Islamic philosophy of religion book, but one may argue that there have been books, or perhaps without the title, but something along those lines. But one main concern that I have is this kind of mixture, which to me, I'm not saying that philosophy of religion and philosophical theology and theology should be absolutely kept separate and independent from each other. There has always been a lot of overlaps, and there should be. But at the same time, there should be a kind of conscious attempt to draw a line of demarcations between them as far as possible methodologically, because if we do not do so, then what is the difference between these disciplines? So they are the same. Whereas in philosophy, we really emphasize a kind of rational as much as it is possible. Of course, there are always constraints and limitations, but at the end of the day, philosophy of religion should be different from philosophical theology and should be different from theology, because it is a different discipline. And for it to become and remain a different discipline, we need to somehow draw a line of demarcation and distinction. And the main thing for me is that, let me give you a very concrete example. I have been very much interested in the question of religious pluralism. Before I got acquainted with John Hick's thought, I was thinking about this question, and I was very much impressed by a kind of pluralistic tendency among Muslim mystics such as Maulana Rumi and Ibn Arabi. And then I became familiar with John Hick, and I myself developed a very kind of pluralistic attitude to religious diversity, and I have written about. Then I became very much interested in John Hick's thought, and I was very much sympathetic. with his thought, and I was in conversation with him, and my wife went to the University of Birmingham to do her PhD study, and I went along with her and with our family, and I was with John Hick for 5 years, having a constant conversation with him at the University of Birmingham. So I may have had some disagreement with him on some, I would say, kind of minor points, but on the major points of religious pluralism, I was generally sympathetic with him. But on the other hand, I had the experience of coming to conversation with Professor Al Plandinga, both in Iran and also in the United States at the University of Notre Dame. And he was kind and gracious enough to invite us to the basement of his house at in South Bend at the University of Notre Dame, when he was retired, actually, in 2010, along with two other colleagues, Iranian colleagues of mine. When he was in Iran, maybe in 2005 or 6, I did not a private conversation, a conversation with other colleagues somewhere in Iran. I asked him this question that you wrote quite explicitly in defense of exclusivism. That's the title of one of your articles. Then how do you, as a Christian philosopher, and particularly as a philosopher of religion, quote unquote, reconcile between the idea of God being compassionate and loving, and on the other hand, being defensive of religious, an opponent of religious exclusivism, which, rationally speaking, leads to the conclusion that God will send perhaps the whole non-religious communities of the whole world throughout the history to the hell, at least to the mainstream understanding of Christian exclusivism. So how do you reconcile between these two ideas within Christianity? He said in Iran that this is a good question you should ask God. And then at Notre Dame, he said, this is a question that I need to still further think about it. So that was a progress for me, at least. But I'm trying to talk about John Hick and Plantinga in terms of this, the focus on question of religious diversity, and try to kind of characterize two methods of doing philosophy of religion. For me, Hick was more philosophical, although he himself was Christian. As he told me, of course, he would take me to his Quaker church rather than any other mainstream church. So, but still, he was quite explicitly Christian. But we know what kind of Christian he was. You may not, or some, at least some Christians do not agree with him that he was Christian anyway. But the thing is that, to me, he was quite sincere in doing philosophy of religion. Whereas people like Alvin Plantinga, although I have admired his philosophy of religion, God on Other Minds, and many, many wonderful books that he has written and enlightened us by with his books. So I do admire him, and I have benefited from him a lot. But at the same time, I do not like that kind of philosophy of religion which doesn't take the question of religious diversity quite seriously and is much more takes a much more theological approach in his philosophy of religion. So by making this distinction and giving you this personal experience, I would like to emphasize that there are two ways of doing philosophy of religion, and perhaps in doing philosophy of religion along the lines of John Hick, then I am having misgivings and doubts and concerns about how to really be faithful to the method of philosophy of religion, and at the same time doing Christian philosophy or Islamic philosophy and things like that. I had some other questions and comments, but I would like to keep it as brief as possible, so I stop here. Thank you so much.
Can you hear me? Testing 1, 2.
Yes,
we can hear you.
Okay. thank you very much for your comments. Brilliant. And I'm so pleased that you have met John Hick, as I have. I think that is, there is a demarcation between philosophy of religion, philosophical theology, and this is an important, I agree with you. I do think philosophical theology is a form of philosophy. So people that do philosophical theology are still doing philosophy. But I feel a great deal of in common with especially Shia, more than Sunni philosophers in philosophy. I did a natural theology, and I found the philosophers much more in a I'm in their camp. Whereas Plantinga, reformed epistemologist, is negative naturalism. He'll use arguments against secular naturalism, but it's a very argument as opposed to a positivistic argument. So I'm extremely appreciative of your comments, and very much hope that you and I might meet in person to discuss. I think I already indicated a little bit the extent that while I'm not exactly with John Hick in terms of his version of pluralism, I am a, well, technically I'm a see it as it's very popular for persons to reflect God, but in my universalism, the overwhelming and he said God will not abandon you for addition. In fact, it was, I'll join you in hell, and we'll until we get out. A great God of love will out altars to come into communion. This might take billions and billions of years. One night, a runner, another Roman Catholic, Balthazar, said, we are real, but hell will be empty.
Okay, Professor Talia Ferro, we have a written question. I don't know if you can hear me or not. We have a written question. I read it for you. What is the difference between meaning and significance? Or do you use them interchangeably? It is the question.
That's an excellent question. I believe that in English, when someone asks, if someone were to come in to this room and say, what is the meaning of this? I would say two things. One, I'm in contact with colleagues in Iran. And secondly, we're discussing the topic of meaning and its and the value of each other's choices in life. So I think that in a way, questions about meaning are questions about just what is there, but it's also a question about values. On this point, some in the West, from David Hume, before Hume too, but David Hume distinguished there are facts and then there are values. I reject this. Many philosophers do now, not all, but many do. That is, many of us believe that facts, many facts involve values. For example, the value of health or the disvalue of disease. If I have cancer, it's a fact. But it's also a fact that this bone cancer is killing me. Now, as far as I know, I do not have cancer right now. But if I did, it's a fact. It would be a fact. So I think that fact and values are very, very, meaning and values are very, very close. Some will use the term meaning simply to refer to causation. For example, as the earlier speaker said, it's getting late. It's about midnight here, and it's snowing. And someone might say, what's the meaning of this? Well, the meaning of this is I am currently in a blizzard that will make driving tomorrow hazardous. That's what this means. I'm in a snow and ice storm, so that any travel in the morning will be dangerous. That's what it means. So the word meaning can mean simply causation. So if someone were to say, I smell smoke going on, it could be an electrical fire. The building is in flames. So meaning can involve just causation, but it's a very close cousin to the notion of not just what it is, but what is its significance. When you think about the pursuit of knowledge at all, almost any context is always going to be hooked up with some kind of value. So my friends who are in the science, most of my friends who do evolutionary biology, they're actually all being funded by corporations or the government in trying to cure cancer. They were, until recently, all united in trying to cure COVID. And that's definitely, they weren't just introduced to this virus for just a pure interest to know about it. They were driven by values. So very little in science, astrophysics, biology, very little is done without some concept of significance. So I would say meaning and significance are hand in glove. Every once in a while, you might just question, what did you mean by that phrase? But I bet you wouldn't ask that unless that had significance for you.
Okay, much. If you allow me, I must say that the part of your answer to the previous question about perhaps 1 minute because of internet was not clearly. It was a very interesting point. You was explaining your difference with John Hick, but we didn't get it. Would you please it? Would you repeat it?
I will. This is, but this is a recent view of mine. Hick was a Christ-centered Christian. He then became a pluralist, so that all religions are authentic paths to God. And in a way, I embrace that as well. But I am, at this point, a Christian where I believe that all of us will ultimately be saved in and through Jesus Christ, that is, the incarnation. Now, this doesn't mean that in this life one must recognize Jesus Christ for salvation. Not at all. But I persist as a Christian inclusivist. As I believe that so much of Islam that I have gained from is as deep as the New Testament and the holy teachings of Christian mystics, and I've learned from Muslim mystics as well. Still, this is the difference between myself and John Hick, is that I think that at the very end of the day, it will be through Christ that all, including you and me, will be brought into communion with God the Father. So I am not a Roman Catholic. I'm technically an Episcopalian. I'm not evangelical. I'm not preaching. I'm not an apologist right now. But I believe in, as it were, a universal salvation like John Hick. But I think it will be as a Christian, it will be through Christ.
Okay, thank you very much. It was very clear and exact. I must thank you again for accepting our invitation, that you lectured what you lectured. You answered our questions. We will try to stay in contact with you. I thank you myself, from side of my colleagues, the students, the participants. Thank you very much. Thank you everyone that participates in this session. Our next session will begin about half an hour. And thank you very much again, Professor Charles Ariofejo. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed this very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.